show where we share our favorite stories from Boston history. This is episode 65, The Boston Strangler. Hi, I'm Nikki.
And I'm Jake. This week, we're going to discuss the Boston Strangler, the hub's most notorious killer, or killers. 13 women were murdered in the early 1960s with the crimes attributed to Albert DeSalvo, based on his confession, details revealed in court during a separate case, and DNA evidence linking him to the last murder victim. However, many questioned the conclusion that DeSalvo was the lone killer. But before we talk about the Strangler, it's time to take a look at this week's featured historic site and upcoming event.
In 1813, the Boston Manufacturing Company opened its doors in Waltham for the manufacture of cotton textiles. The company was organized by Francis Cabot Lowell, a wealthy Boston merchant, in partnership with a group of investors known as the Boston Associates. The company became the first integrated textile mill in the United States with the goal of eliminating the problems of coordination, quality control, and shipping inherent in the subcontracting-based textile industry. Run solely off of water power, the Boston Associates used plans for a power loom that Lowell smuggled out of England, as well as trade secrets from the earlier horse-powered Beverly Cotton Manufactory of Beverly, Massachusetts, in 1788. It was a very efficient, highly profitable mill that, with the aid of the tariff of 1816, competed effectively with the British textiles at a time when many smaller operations were being forced out of business. The Boston Associates attempted to create a well-controlled system of labor, which varied from the harsh conditions endured elsewhere. The mill owners recruited young Yankee farm girls from the surrounding area to come and work the machines at Waltham. The mill girls, as they came to be known, lived in boarding houses provided by the company and were supervised by older women and were subject to strict codes of conduct. They worked approximately 80 hours per week. The workers would wake up to the factory bell at 4:40 in the morning, report to work at 5, and have a half-hour breakfast break at 7 a.m. They would then work until the half-hour to 45-minute lunch break at noon, and at 7 p.m., the factory would shut down and the workers would return to their company houses. This routine was followed 6 days a week and became known as the Waltham system. By the early 1820s, the water power of the Charles River at Waltham was just about maximized, and the investors sought a new location to build even more mills. As the Merrimack Manufacturing Company in 1822, they copied the Waltham system in the new city of Lowell. The same group of investors would establish Lawrence, Massachusetts, Manchester, New Hampshire, and several other new industrial centers throughout New England during the first half of the 19th century. The factory methods introduced at Waltham would also be copied by other industries in the years to follow. The Waltham site would be expanded again during the late 19th century. The original mills were connected, the gable roofs removed, and additional floors were added with flat roofs. The Boston Manufacturing Company closed in 1930. Fittingly, today the site is occupied by the Charles River Museum of Industry and Innovation. Located near the intersection of the Charles River and Moody Street, the museum houses and displays machinery and artifacts of the Industrial Revolution from the 19th and 20th centuries. The mission of the Charles River Museum of Industry and Innovation is to encourage and inspire future innovation in America. The museum accomplishes this through its collections and programs, by exploring the historical impact of industry on American culture, by examining the dynamic process of innovation, by promoting its location in Waltham as a foundation of the American Industrial Revolution, by connecting the expertise of older generations with the inquisitiveness of young people, and by providing audiences of all ages with an engaging museum experience. Core exhibits cover the area's role in the American Industrial Revolution, though the museum also has a dedicated gallery of the Waltham Watch Company to note the city's watchmaking history. The museum is open for limited hours Thursday through Sunday and will reopen on February 17th after some renovations to improve its wheelchair accessibility. We'll link to the museum's website in this week's show notes.
And for our upcoming event this week, we're featuring an up-close tour at the Boston Athenaeum. Up-close tours encourage visitors to look closely at materials from the Athenaeum's rich collections and consider them within a particular context. On Wednesday, February 7th, from 11 to 11:30 a.m., join Boston Athenaeum docent Joyce Bowden for a journey through 100 years of the Adams family's public service, as illuminated by four objects in the Athenaeum's special collections. Joyce will lead a discussion around John Adams and Thomas Jefferson's correspondence, John Quincy Adams' defense of the Amistad captives, and Charles Francis Adams's work to keep England out of the U.S. Civil War. The tour will be held again on February 21st. Both are free with admission, and registration is required. For those of you who, like us, can't easily make it to a weekday morning event, there's an upcoming evening lecture, Exodus from Dixie, The Great Migration as a Social Movement, on Thursday, March 1st, from 6 to 7 p.m. The Athenaeum's website offers the following description. Between 1915 and 1930, over 1.5 million African Americans fled the U.S. South for northern and western cities and locales. Just 10 years later, another 6 million would begin the same trek in search of a better life. This epic migration literally changed the complexion of America. But why did it take place? Standard accounts mark the closing off of European migration during World War I and the need for industrial labor. However, listening to the voices, hearing the songs, and viewing the artwork of actual migrants uncovers a different story. The Great Migration was not simply a response to economic forces. These migrants were quitting the South. Tracing the lives of migrants reveals the Great Migration as a social movement, what many called an exodus from Dixie. And yet, upon entering the urban North and West, the American dream remained elusive. The liberties of walking tall, voting in elections, and working on integrated shop floors came with the price of racially restrictive neighborhoods, firebombings and race riots, and unfair policing and hiring practices. Following the path of Southern migrants in search of a better life, with its twists and detours, speaks to the hopes and limits of the American dream for us all. This event is the first program in the American Dream series, which explores how our conceptions of the American dream are shaped or negated. The event is $20 for non-members, and registration is required. We'll post links to both events in the show notes this week.
On June 14, 1962, Anna Slessers, age 55, was found brutally molested, strangled, and murdered in her third-floor apartment on Gainsborough Street near Symphony Hall. Her son discovered her body at 7:45 p.m., 2 hours and 15 minutes after she was seen arriving home, when he came to take her to church. She was dressed in a house coat that was ripped open, with the cord knotted around her neck in a bow. Police questioned 8 men, and all were released. The next 2 years were a pretty tense time to be a woman in the greater Boston area. 13 women were murdered in a spree that baffled all of the surrounding police departments. The women ranged in age from 19 to 85. They were of different races, different ethnicities, and lived in several different towns. Most of them were sexually assaulted, but some weren't. Most were strangled, but 2 were stabbed. In every case, there was no sign of forced entry. The women were assumed to have let their assailant in, either because they knew him or because they believed him to be an apartment maintenance man, delivery man, or some other service professional. The attacks continued despite the enormous media publicity after the first few murders, which presumably would have discouraged women from admitting strangers into their homes. Sophie Clark, the 7th victim, had made a pact with her roommate that they would never be home alone, yet she was attacked and killed on a night that her roommate had to work late. It would seem that someone going to that degree of care wouldn't let a strange man into her apartment. This puzzling aspect of each crime added to the terror and confusion.
In 1964, The Atlantic, then based in Boston, published an article by Earl Gardner, a distinguished criminologist best known for creating Perry Mason. In it, he described women living in constant fear. What do you do about the door when you enter? You look in the closets, under the bed, and in the bathroom. If a man is in there, you want to be able to run out screaming for help. Therefore, you should leave the door open. But if you leave the door open while you're making a search, what's to prevent the strangler from following you in and standing between you and your means of escape when you first see him? An anecdote from the Mass Moments website tells us that so many people went to the Animal Rescue League for watchdogs that the league's supply was exhausted. 40 years later, a reporter said, "You're asking if people were scared? I covered the murders and I was scared. I had an elderly mother in Medford, and after the fifth strangling, I was so scared I went over to her apartment and installed 2 deadbolts. But after a while, you couldn't buy them. Sold out." We'll post a link in the show notes to a Life magazine pictorial that shows all the various ways women attempted to protect themselves. One woman lit a cigarette for the walk home so that if attacked, she could put it out in the assailant's eye. She also kept a hat pin on her sleeve. Another set up bottles inside her door so that the noise of an intruder coming in would wake her. Women slept with items like ski poles and umbrellas for protection. They carried police whistles, took karate lessons, and asked their dates to search their apartments at the end of the night.
It would take up a lot of time and emotional bandwidth to discuss each of the murders, so we're focusing on the final victim and then the events that followed. Mary Sullivan, the youngest and last victim, moved into an apartment at 44 Charles Street at the foot of Beacon Hill on January 1st, 1964. She had just gotten a job as a clerk at a downtown department store and moved in with 3 of her coworkers. A few days later, on the 4th, she had the day off and decided to stay home to finish unpacking. When her roommates returned, they found her naked body laying in the front hallway with a stocking tied around her neck. There was a card propped up against her foot that said "Happy New Year." Though Mary Sullivan would be the final victim, the city and surrounding towns remained on high alert. The strangler spree was not the first time that Boston area women were at risk of attack. Several years prior, a series of sex offenses began in and around Cambridge. A predatory man in his late 20s went door to door in search of victims, posing as a talent scout for a modeling agency. If a young woman answered the door and she was interested, he would tell her that he needed to get her measurements. This proved to be a successful guise, as many women allowed him to measure them. He would then fondle the women as he took the measurements. Several women contacted the police, and this man was referred to as the Measuring Man. In the fall of 1964, in addition to the Boston Strangler murders, the police were also trying to solve a series of rapes committed by a man who had been named the Green Man. All told, the Boston Strangler would strike in 5 cities and towns: Boston, Cambridge, Lynn, Lawrence, and Salem. This led to a cumbersome investigation as jurisdictions struggled to figure out how to work together. Massachusetts Attorney General Edward Brooke helped to coordinate the various police forces. He controversially permitted psychometrist Peter Herkus to use his alleged extrasensory perception to analyze the cases at the request of private citizens. During World War II, Herkus was a member of the Dutch Resistance and was imprisoned at Buchenwald. He claimed to have developed extrasensory perception after recovering from a head injury and coma caused by a fall from a ladder at age 30.
In his 1964 Atlantic article, Gardner reports, "Herkos did some remarkable things. He told a police officer about his ailing mother and described her illness in detail. He told one officer that something was wrong with his child's throat and that he should telephone home immediately. The officer did so, only to learn that his small daughter had just swallowed a safety pin. And he swept through a series of demonstrations in telepathy, extrasensory perception, clairvoyance, or whatever one cares to call it, a force which he admits he does not fully understand. Then he turned his attention to the murders. He was shown photographs, the physical evidence, and taken to the scene of at least one of the crimes. He had little hesitancy in declaring that all 11 of the murders were the work of one strangler. There are those in police circles who doubt that this is the case. They feel almost certain that one of the murders, at least, a typical sordid hotel sex slaying, is removed from the pattern of the other murders and was perpetrated by someone other than the Mad Strangler. Many veteran officers feel that there is one other case, or perhaps two, in which the Mad Strangler is not the murderer. The Attorney General uses carefully chosen words to describe the talents of Peter Hurkos. In a prepared statement released by the Attorney General, his gift was called psychometry. Some red-faced police officer may well find himself on the witness stand and called upon to answer some such question as, "Oh, so you first took my client into custody and now want to send him to the electric chair on the strength of a vision by some 20th century witch doctor. Is that right?"
Before the Strangler struck Boston, back in March of 1960, police caught a man named Albert DeSalvo mid-burglary. He confessed to the break-in, and without any interrogation, he also confessed to being the aforementioned measuring man. He was sentenced to 18 months in jail, but was released after 11 for good behavior. He then promptly began a new crime spree, in which he dressed in a green work suit, broke into homes, and sexually assaulted women. On October 27, 1964, DeSalvo entered a young woman's home in East Cambridge, posing as a detective. He tied the victim to her bed, proceeded to sexually assault her, but suddenly left, saying, "I'm sorry," as he went. The woman's description led police to identify him, and when his photo was published, many other women identified him as the green man who had assaulted them. DeSalvo's crimes were so frequent that just earlier that day, he had posed as a motorist with car trouble and attempted to enter a home in Bridgewater. The owner of the home, future Brockton Police Chief Richard Sproles, became suspicious and ultimately fired a shotgun at DeSalvo. Albert DeSalvo was not initially suspected of being involved with any of the stranglings. It was only after he was charged with rape, as the Green Man, that he gave a detailed confession of his activities as the Boston Strangler. He initially confessed to fellow inmate George Nasser while under observation at the Bridgewater State Hospital for the Criminally Insane. Nasser reported the confession to his attorney, F. Lee Bailey, who also took on DeSalvo's case. The police were impressed with the accuracy of DeSalvo's descriptions of the crime scenes, but there were some inconsistencies. DeSalvo was able to cite details which had not been made public. However, there was no physical evidence to substantiate his confession. Ultimately, he stood trial for the earlier, unrelated crimes of robbery and sexual offenses as the Green Man, but was never charged as the Boston Strangler.
Mass Moments describes the strategy that his confession was meant to play at the Green Man trial. On March 6, 1965, with F. Lee Bailey as his defense attorney, Albert DeSalvo confessed to killing the 11 Strangler victims and two other women. Police did not charge DeSalvo with the Strangler murders, but with the robbery and assault that had led to his arrest. His trial began on January 10, 1967. Although a forensic psychiatrist testified that DeSalvo suffered from schizophrenia and was a compulsive confessor who desperately needs to be recognized, F. Lee Bailey believed his client's confession. The renowned lawyer decided to use the 13 murders he had committed as the Boston Strangler to show the extent of his insanity. Bailey conceded that the problem was unusual. I wanted to defend a man for robbery and assault by proving that he had committed 13 murders. The strategy failed. After a week-long trial, DeSalvo was found guilty of assault and robbery and sentenced to life. He was sent back to Bridgewater. As far as the public was concerned, the Boston Strangler was behind bars. No one was ever arrested or tried for the Strangler crimes.
DeSalvo escaped with two fellow inmates from Bridgewater, triggering a full-scale manhunt. A note was found on his bunk addressed to the superintendent. In it, DeSalvo stated that he had escaped to focus attention on the conditions in the hospital and his own situation. 3 days after the escape, he called his lawyer to turn himself in. And following the escape, he was transferred to the maximum security prison in Walpole, where he later recanted his Strangler confessions. On November 25, 1973, he was found stabbed to death in the prison infirmary. Robert Wilson, who was associated with the Winterhill gang, was tried for DeSalvo's murder, but the trial ended in a hung jury. As with his alleged victims, no one was ever convicted for his murder. Many doubt that DeSalvo was the Boston Strangler and believe that the real murderer could still be at large. Former FBI profiler Robert Ressler has said, "You're putting together so many different patterns regarding the Boston Strangler murders that it's inconceivable behaviorally that these could all fit one individual." Others point to the inconsistencies in his confession, as well as the financial gain. Ames Roby, a former prison psych who analyzed both DeSalvo and Nassar, has called Nassar a misogynistic, psychopathic killer, and a far more likely suspect than DeSalvo, leading to speculation that Nassar is the strangler, and he fed details of the murders to DeSalvo. It's plausible that DeSalvo knew he would spend the rest of his life in jail as the Green Man and confessed so that, upon his conviction, Nassar could collect reward money that they would split. DeSalvo would then have gone on to a life of infamous celebrity with opportunities to sell his story. Speaking to this need for notoriety, Roby testified that Albert so badly wanted to be the strangler.
In the year 2000, Elaine Whitfield Sharp, an attorney specializing in forensic cases, began representing the families of DeSalvo and of Mary Sullivan, both to clear DeSalvo's name and to reignite efforts to find Sullivan's real killer. Sharp obtained court approval to exhume both Sullivan and DeSalvo for DNA testing, filed several court actions to obtain information and physical evidence from the government, and worked with various film producers to create documentaries so as to better educate the public. Through these efforts, Sharp was able to identify several inconsistencies between DeSalvo's confessions and the crime scene evidence, casting even more doubts over DeSalvo's identity as the Boston Strangler. Contrary to DeSalvo's statement that he first raped Sullivan, the forensic investigation revealed no evidence to support that claim. Also, he did not, as he claimed, strangle her with his bare hands. Instead, she was strangled by ligature. Forensic pathologist Michael Baden noted that DeSalvo incorrectly stated the time of the victim's death, a detail that DeSalvo got wrong in several of the murders. Perhaps most importantly, James Starrs, professor of forensic science at George Washington University, concluded that a semen-like substance on her body did not match DeSalvo's DNA and could not associate him with her murder.
However, another break in the case came in the summer of 2013. Seminal fluid had been lifted from a maroon blanket that was draped over Sullivan's body. The New York Times describes how the case progressed 50 years later. Don Hayes of the Boston Police Department Crime Lab found the blanket among a trove of police evidence in 1998, and the department received slides with the samples taken from Miss Sullivan's body in the early 2000s. But early attempts to recover usable DNA samples were inconclusive, so Mr. Hayes stored the samples and waited for technology to improve. Last fall, investigators sent the samples to two private labs for another try, and this time got a DNA profile for an unknown male. The DNA profile matched one from a water bottle that had recently been used and discarded by a nephew of Mr. DeSalvo's, which investigators had obtained by trailing him. Investigators said they used a test of male chromosomes passed from generation to generation and found a match that gave them virtual certainty of Mr. DeSalvo's guilt. A Superior Court judge in Boston granted permission to exhume Mr. DeSalvo's remains so that a final identification could be made. While the authorities say the evidence about Mr. DeSalvo's role in Ms. Sullivan's death is all but decisive, they acknowledged that it only applied to her murder, not to any of the others to which Mr. DeSalvo confessed. "We don't claim with certainty that Albert DeSalvo is a suspect in each of them," District Attorney Dan Conley said, "but we do believe that we stand on the threshold of unprecedented certainty regarding Mary Sullivan's murder."
To learn more about the Boston Strangler, check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/065. We'll have a link to Earl Gardner's Atlantic article, profiles of each victim from the Boston Globe, a photo series from Life magazine documenting life during the crime spree, and a list of books for further reading. And of course, we'll have links to information about this week's featured historic site and upcoming event. We're happy to share some listener feedback from Facebook this week. Michelle comments, I just started listening to your show a few weeks ago. Bravo on an excellent podcast. I'm familiar with many of your stories from my experience as a Boston by Foot tour guide, but you add some great details and flavor even to facts I know. The Hayden Minkin Sims Burns series was outstanding. I learned their stories from a special tour created a few years ago on the abolition movement in Boston. The rescues, attempts, and protests are so dramatic and shocking that it baffles me how I never learned any of this in school. It would make a great movie. Editor's note, we're big fans of Boston by Foot and highly recommend a membership to local listeners who want to get out this summer and enjoy an incredibly wide range of walking tours.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're Hub History on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. While you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode. If you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, please think about writing us a brief review. It's the best way to help others discover the show.
That's all for now. We'll be back next time to talk about how much Cotton Mather hated pirates.